You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tiecher. One of the biggest challenges that has confronted me through a seemingly endless number of interviews about the COVID pandemic is figuring out how to talk about our immune systems. Now, first of all, the immune system is unbelievably complex. Second, there is a lot we don't know about how it works. Third, we usually talk about the immune system using metaphors. You know, it's boosted like a race car, or it is suppressed like a riot, or it is fighting like an army. Sometimes the immune system is helping us. Sometimes it is the thing that is killing us. And all of these metaphors give us something to grasp at, but they can also box us into ways of thinking that aren't terribly useful. Figuring out how to talk and communicate effectively about the immune system at a time when the stakes are very high for all of us is how I happened to cross our next guest's book. Daniel M. Davis is a professor of immunology at the University of Manchester. He set out to explain what we know by telling the stories of people across generations groping toward a better understanding of how our bodies respond to infections. His book is The Beautiful Cure, The Revolution in Immunology and What It Means for Your Health. Professor Davis, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Brian. Wonderful to be here. And that was actually a really lovely introduction to the topic. Thank you.
I want to start where you kind of lay out the stakes of the book, the problem that you keep confronting to, which is that to mount a response to infections, our body has to be able to distinguish between what is self, what is the body, and what is a threat.
Right. That's exactly the modern view of thinking about how the immune system works. And there's a lot of depth in that very simple statement that you just said. For example, we might think of the body reacting to anything that's not part of itself, which is, to a first approximation, how the immune system really works. So roughly speaking, your body's immune system learns what's part of you, what's part of it, of yourself, and then it reacts to things that are not part of you. But of course, that doesn't tell the whole story, because there are things in the air, dust particles, things that are not going to be a threat to the body, and yet you need your immune system to not react to that. And even more subtle than that, there are bacteria that reside in your gut, which are in fact good for the body. And yet those very same bacteria, if they were somewhere else in the body, they might cause, for example, a urinary tract infection or some other problem. So the immune system is exceptionally complex to be able to recognize what is going to cause a problem, what is a threat versus what isn't. And the way that it does that is, I think, one of the most wondrous things about how the human body works. And it's certainly one of the complicated parts of the body that we do understand in some great depth. You know, obviously thinking about how the brain works is of course equally, or perhaps more, wondrous, but we don't understand a huge amount about how that really works. Whereas the immune system is probably where we have the details excavated the deepest.
So if we start at the clock, like when human understanding starts groping towards a working knowledge of how the body responds to disease, It turns out, I got from reading your book, we have to actually start earlier than where my grade school textbooks did, with Edward Jenner figuring out that milkmaids who got cowpox didn't get smallpox. For centuries earlier, societies have been trying to lower the impact of smallpox by exposing people to it in a controlled fashion.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So before Edward Jenner, in fact, there were sort of folklore experiments. They weren't really experiments, but there were traditions that led to people realizing that if they were exposed to a particular infection, then it would be unlikely they'd get that same infection again. And then, as you say, Edward Jenner did the landmark experiment that might be said to have started this field of immunology. It was the 14th of May, 1796, that he performed the experiment where he took pus from a dairy maid who'd been infected with cowpox from one of her cows, Blossom, in fact. And then he inoculated his gardener's 8-year-old son. Clearly the ethics of doing these kinds of experiments were very different in those days to now. And the 8-year-old boy, the gardener's son, was then given pus from a smallpox patient and didn't get ill. And so that began our journey of thinking about how the immune system works, and of course is the basis of how a vaccine works. And Jenner did always believe, in fact, that what he showed there was something that could lead to the complete annihilation of smallpox from the planet. And it did do that. I think it was around 1980 that we finally declared that smallpox had been eradicated. But Jenner never, of course, had any idea about exactly how that process worked. It was a huge landmark experiment, but it didn't come from a deep understanding. So essentially, what's been happening since that moment, since 1796, since that time, we've been trying to work out exactly how does that work? How does your immune system recognize the presence of a threat and then build up an immunity so that if that threat happens again, you react better, faster a second time round? So that's the whole journey that I've tried to write about in this book.
Well, let's zoom forward to today, and maybe you could walk us through the state of our present knowledge. Like, what do we understand happens in the human body when, say, a COVID virus first attaches to a cell in your respiratory tract and hijacks its machinery to start multiplying?
Yes. So your body can't react to just anything that's not part of itself. It has to detect that there is really a problem. And it was, in fact, not until 1989 that a scientist, Charlie Janeway, made a huge leap forward in thinking about how that happens. And he realized that we didn't really understand at that time exactly what got an immune reaction to begin, what made it really start off. So when a virus enters one of our body's cells, what is it exactly that really makes the immune system kick off? And he postulated, or guessed, for want of a better word, really, that there was receptors receptors on the surface of immune cells that could lock on to parts of germs or telltale signs of germs that would tell the body that there was a germ in this particular location that needs a response. And he didn't really have any evidence for that. He just sort of guessed that there had to be a whole realm of how the immune system works that nobody had thought about before. So people had thought a lot about what makes the immune system work better a second time round, but they hadn't really begun to think as much about what got the immune response started in the first place. And the way that you just phrased that question was exactly the type of thing that he was thinking about when his wife, Kim Bockling, was also a well-known immunologist, and together they were just chatting and they were at a scientific meeting, and they realized, well, that question, what happens when the germ enters the body, what really gets it to begin? And he realized that people didn't know. So he guessed that there had to be this whole part of the immune system that hadn't been uncovered yet that would recognize the telltale sign of a germ. I write about this in the book, and it's a fascinating story that sort of hops along across the globe, because he postulated that there were these receptors. His ideas were essentially ignored for around 8 years. But a student in the University of Ruslan Medzhitov, who's now the University of Yale, and he wrote to Charlie Janeway while he was a student in Moscow, saying that he found these ideas fascinating. And eventually, Ruslan Medzhitov got the chance to come and work with Charlie Janeway in the USA, and together they started to unravel what really happens. They learned a lot also from how flies are detecting the presence of germs by other scientists working in Paris. And eventually we get to this picture where the immune system has receptors on it, on the surface of its immune cells, that can lock on to, for example, the outside coating of a bacteria as something that obviously shouldn't be there in a particular place in the body where it shouldn't be. And it can lock on to parts of viruses that the genetic material of a virus that is now in a wrong place. There should be no genetic material in this position within a cell, but there is some. That must be a virus. And so your body has these abilities to detect the presence of things that just should not be there. And that is crucial to kickstarting the immune response. So now when this virus enters into your cells, your body will detect some components of that virus as being telltale signs of a virus. And that will then begin the immune response. Now, different immune cells will then move in to the region where this virus has entered the body. That, well, some cells can directly attack the virus-infected cells straight away. But other cells will pick up cells, fragments of cells sometimes, that have been infected with the virus, and they will take these components of the germ to lymph nodes and present fragments of the molecules that are made by the virus to other immune cells. Now, these other immune cells, some of them will be particularly good at seeing that virus. And these are the cells that are called B cells and T cells. And the very small fraction of your body's cells that are able to then see that particular virus will then start to multiply in number. And the B cells then will produce antibodies against that germ. The T cells may move out, and some types of those T cells can directly attack, for example, the virus-infected cells. And that very precise, tailored part of the immune system is often called your adaptive immune response. And that takes some days to develop. So you have this initial innate recognition of something, a telltale sign of a germ is there, we need a response. Some cells can then start to attack the virus very immediately. But other cells take some time to multiply number to mount an effective immune response. And that's called your adaptive immune response that takes a few days. Now, when your body has eradicated the germ, then some of those adaptive immune cells, the T cells and B cells, some of them then switch into a different version of that cell that lives in the body for a long time. And they then can mount an immune response relatively quickly if your body sees that same germ again. Hopefully that's a rough sense of what's going on for you.
It is so mind-blowing to me that our bodies, which have never been exposed to the SARS-CoV-2 virus before, already have built in the capacity to recognize it and respond to it. That the immune response is just a question of the time it takes to scale up that response.
Oh, that issue is for me the most wondrous part of how the whole immune system works. And we have to talk about that. So, because you're right, you know, it does seem on the face of it, how can your body have an immune response against something that hasn't even existed in the universe before, if you go back, a few years? So what happens is that your immune cells, well, these B cells and T cells specifically, they have the ability to detect things that have never existed before in the universe. And the way that this works is, so the B cell will, as it develops in the bone marrow, it shuffles about its genes. And the cells don't normally rearrange a few of their genes, but B cells will rearrange a handful of the genes inside the cell each time a new B cell is being made. So by that subtle shift in genes, an individual B cell will make a protein molecule at its surface that has a uniquely shaped tip to it. So a B cell will make at its surface a protein molecule with a unique shape to it. And each B cell then will have its own one of these molecules that has a unique shape. So every B cell has a slightly different shaped special protein at its surface called the B cell receptor. Now, each B cell will be tested to see if the shape of molecule that it has, if it can stick to anything normally made by the human body, then that B cell is killed off because it would be too dangerous. That immune cell now would be able to react against something in the human body. So that B cell needs to be killed off. So what you're left with after that process is a whole bunch of B cells that have a uniquely shaped receptor at their surface to stick to something, but it cannot stick to anything normally made in the human body. So you have this
How many unique types of B cells do I have?
When I say a bunch of B cells, what I mean is 10 billion. So you have 10 billion B cells in your body that have the ability to stick to something that is not made in the human body, because if any of them happen to have by chance made a receptor that could stick to the human body, that has been killed off. So you're left with these B cells which move through the blood, the lymph, your organs, your tissues, throughout all of the human body. You have 10 billion of them, all equipped to stick to something that does not come from the human body. Now, when you have an infection, the general idea then is that some of those B cells will, by chance, have the right shaped receptor to stick to that particular germ. And when the B cell locks on to the germ, then that triggers the B cell. If you like, that B cell realizes it has the right shaped receptor, the right shuffling of genes. It now has the right receptor to detect that germ. And then that B cell takes those genes and makes a soluble version of that molecule. It secretes out the protein itself, and that's what we call antibodies. And that B cell multiplies in number to make a huge amount of that antibody, which is the right molecule to lock onto the germ. And so the wonderful idea is that shuffling about some genes creates randomly shaped proteins. Any that stick to the human body, any cell that has one that can stick to something in the human body is killed off. So you have a whole bunch of immune cells ready to go against any shaped thing that doesn't exist in the universe. There's been no they're not designed to stick to germs. They're just there to stick to things that are not part of the human body. And then when they have the right thing, they multiply in number, and that's how you get this effective immune response against new germs.
So is that why, most minor infections seem to last about the same amount of time, about 2 weeks to full recovery? Just the math of how long it takes for the right cell to find the right germ and then replicate to big enough numbers to wipe it out?
Yes. So that's why it does take often a few days to recover from illnesses that the body can deal with fairly effectively. But there are actually lots and lots of sort of subtle factors that play into that. So the history of infections you've had, aging, the genetics of each individual person, there are many things that play into how well you recover from. So for example, if you get infected with a flu virus, you might recover in 3 days. And if I get infected with that exact same flu virus, I might recover in 4 days. And the reasons for that could come from the history of infections we've had, the age we're at, all sorts of factors. And one of the key factors, though, is our genetics. So in actual fact, the genes which vary the most between you and me and everyone listening to this are in our immune system. So we actually each have a slightly different configuration of immune system, if you like, and that allows us to respond differently to different germs. That's why you might recover faster than me with one particular flu virus. But it doesn't mean that your immune system is any better than mine overall, because with a different virus, I might recover a bit faster than you. So each of us have a uniqueness to our immune system, and that plays into how long it takes for us to recover from any type of illness.
So you've just described this very intricate dance of random variation and then selection, educating the immune system about what it's okay to leave alone, and then a kind of mathematically precise response when something is identified in the body that shouldn't be there. And hearing it described as that dance, that learning system, makes me think very skeptically about the section of my local pharmacy full of things that promise to boost the immune system. What does it mean to boost or suppress the immune system?
Right. So depends which section of the pharmacy you're in, because obviously there are some medicines that do genuinely work very well against for boosting and dampening the immune system. And what we mean by that is that Well, let's take the example of the flu infection that we just spoke about. So when your body will have all these cells multiplied in number to produce, for example, the right antibodies against that particular flu, and your T cells will be multiplied in number to kill the flu virus that when it's infected your body's cells. So your body goes into this sort of heightened state to kill off the virus. But when your body has eradicated the virus, then the immune system has to come back to its normal resting level. So the immune system has within it its own brake system, its own ability to switch off after a while. So the immune system is not, it's not something that has a sort of steady state of activity. It fluctuates. So your immune system can heighten in activity and go down in activity. And what we're doing then in medicines, I'm talking about sort of medicines rather than nutritional products. So medicines can influence the ability of the immune system to get into that heightened state. For example, to fight off cancer over a long period of time, you don't want those breaks to come on. So you want to stop those breaks from working. So there are medicines that block the breaks on the immune system to boost the ability of the immune system or to maintain the ability of the immune system to keep fighting off cancer, for an example. Or if you have an autoimmune disease, then there are medicines that work by stopping the immune system becoming activated. And one of the ways they do that is that immune cells signal to each other. They sort of egg each other on by secreting soluble molecules. Some medicines work by stopping that communication, by blocking the ability of immune cells to egg each other on in an immune response. And that then weakens the immune system, which is what you want to do to stop an autoimmune disease, which is when, of course, your immune system is reacting against parts of the body when it shouldn't be. And you need to switch off that immune response because it's in that situation, it's damaging to the human body. So those are medicines which do boost or dampen the immune activity to help us therapeutically.
What about things we have more control over? Sleeping, nutrition, you know, whether we spend time out in the cold without a sweater on. How much do they impact the state of our immune system?
Right. So this is a very important issue. And, you know, so in my book, I do write a whole large section on that. And it's something I get asked about a lot. And I have to say that my view as a scientist is not to necessarily give people very direct advice or sort of public health messages. It's more that I want you to sort of understand what we know and what we don't know, and then you can kind of make up your own mind. So one of the things I've looked into in some depth, for example, are things to do with Tai Chi or mindfulness. You know, do they boost your immune system, for example? Now, it is most of the things that you could look into as things that are sort of advertised as boosting your immune system, when we're not talking about a sort of pharmaceutical medicine, if we're talking about a lifestyle situation, then most of it is very, very hard to know the answer. And that is simply because the experiments themselves are genuinely very, very hard to do. So, you know, if you wanted to investigate whether practicing something like Tai Chi might boost your immune system, the actual experiment is just really hard to do because you can't just take people that do Tai Chi versus people that don't, because you've already that the people that do Tai Chi may have lots of other things about their life that's different in general from people that don't. So I would say for most of the things like that, it's really, really hard to know. The only thing where scientists do tend to agree is that stress does impact the immune system. And so the thinking behind that really is that, you know, when your body goes into this sort of heightened state of stress, a flight or fight response, then that produces this hormone cortisol, and that tends to dampen the immune system. And the rough thinking is that if your body's in this emergency situation, then it doesn't need to worry about an immediate thing your immune system has to do, and its energy should be used more directly for the flight or fight situation. So your body quietens down the immune system when you're in a state of stress. And that seems to be true even if you're in a sort of chronic stress. And we're talking about all kinds of different stresses, from, you know, losing your job to a long-term marital problem. Any all types of stresses can impact your immune system. But having said that...
what does it mean to dampen down your immune system? Does that mean your body's just putting fewer T cells and B cells into circulation?
See, when your body is producing a lot of this cortisol hormone, then the immune cells don't move as fast. They're not as good at killing bacteria-infected cells. So there are actually lots of those things vary with levels of cortisol in a person's blood, which in turn correlates with stress levels. But having said that, I think most scientists would agree with that. But where there's less agreement is whether or not practices that reduce stress impact the immune system. That's where it's much, much harder to get good evidence for the reasons actually I just said. It's hard to do that for lifestyle things or practicing something like Tai Chi, mindfulness, things that might be thought to reduce stress. So it's quite hard to know. So I would that's my answer, that the experiments are hard to do and we don't really know the answer.
That's a down note to end on. But Daniel Davis, I want to thank you very much for the book and for the conversation about it.
Thank you so much, Brian. Lovely to talk to you. Thank you.
Daniel M. Davis is a professor of immunology at the University of Manchester in the UK. His most recent book, it was published just before the pandemic. It's entitled The Beautiful Cure, The Revolution in Immunology and What It Means for Your Health.